Hello, this is Phyllis Furumoto with Reiki, Balancing Form and Essence. This month, the month of May, we're going to start a new element, and this is the element called Form of Teaching. Now, perhaps some of you are going to say, what does that mean? And it has to do with putting all the other elements together into a class form. And part of the form of the system not only is about the information and about the way in which we use the information, but also it's how it's taught. And one of the main things that I really gathered from my sitting in classes with Hawaii Otakata, who also happened to be my grandmother, was that there's no fear in Reiki. And so she never taught with fear. She never said, well, if you do this, then something bad will happen. That didn't happen. And that, for me, is a part of the form of teaching. So I'll give you a little bit of an example. And today I have the great pleasure of having Rick Bochner to interview. He's one of the masters that Hawaii Otakata initiated. And I was lucky enough to be at his initiation and sit in the classes as she taught during the time of his initiation. Rick and I are about the same age and the same interests in life, so we were able to accompany each other in some of our great moments of mastery, and especially in these first few months and maybe even a year right after he was initiated, and trying to figure out how we were going to teach a class, and realizing that we weren't Hawaii Otakata, we didn't have her stories, and we certainly weren't alike in her personality and ours. So we had some great conversations I'd like to revisit there. And also, Rick has, in the last few years, started to travel into the international community, especially in the Netherlands and in England and other places that I probably don't even know about. And I wanted to get his take on the influence of culture and the teaching of class, because, well, it's just a question that I have, and certainly it's been influential in my own teaching. So with that, and no further ado, Rick, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Phyllis. Nice to be here.
It's great to have you. Let's see, where to start. Okay, why don't you start with your story of how you came to Reiki? And how it was, and kind of a little bit more in the sense of, what was it like to sit in a class with Hawaii Otakata as a student?
Well, okay, I'll try and pull this up here. I came to Reiki through a series of, sort of, well, in the larger scheme of things, mild mishaps, but at the time they all seemed quite cataclysmic. And and I was kind of knocked back on my heels for a while and left to consider what I was doing and what my life was about. And, you know, you create space around yourself in crisis, and that often gives you time to process or think about whatever you need to learn from that. And in my case, I had tried to go and see Mrs. Takata earlier after she was at Barbara Brown's house in 1975 or 6 or something. I guess it was a little later. It would have been 77, I guess. And it just didn't work out. And the following year, I was in a newly separated marriage and having a hard time with that. And a friend of mine came back from a class and just said, she's back and you have to go. And I resisted. I said, I don't know why I have to go. What's this got to do with me? I'm not a healer. And well, it's about hands, and it's about energy, and you're a musician and a gardener and a woodworker and a craftsperson. So just stop talking, get in the truck. And they basically picked me up, put me in the truck, gave me some gas money and a map, and sent me out of there. Mm-hmm. That's what it took.
So a little bit of force.
I wasn't particularly looking, but I got it anyway. And then when I ended up at Barbara's place, there were five Reiki masters there. There was Bethel Fay and Wanya Twan and Barbara Brown and you and Mrs. Takata. And during the class at some point, I was listening to her speak, and all of a sudden, I remembered this dream that I'd had that was a very powerful visual dream and ended with myself sitting in a small cabin in the woods with five kind of granny masters of something, and all of a sudden here I was, and the energy just absolutely washed over me like climbing into a hot bath. It's just a little too hot, kind of takes your breath away, you know.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And at that point I felt like I was really somewhere very special, and that this required my full attention. And I spoke to her after the class and told her about this and expressed an interest in learning more. And I didn't know what I was saying, Phyllis. You know, that's what's amazing is I didn't have a clue what it entailed. I just knew that, okay, right now, go up there and talk to her and just tell her you want to learn more. You'd like to be able to teach this. And, she considered it for a while and thought about it and asked me to write a letter, which is something I still do with people that ask.
Mm-hmm.
No emails, no phone calls, you know. Get out the old pen and show me what your handwriting looks like and tell me why on earth you would want to do this.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it was a really important link because it mm-hmm. gave me a chance to try and think about it. And I like writing. I could express things that way that mm-hmm. I couldn't necessarily touch verbally. Anyway, after a period of months writing back and forth, she accepted me as a student, and she returned to the Kootenays on several occasions, and I think I sat in on six or seven classes in the time that I was studying with her. I wish it could have been more, but she passed away 3 months after I was initiated, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing that I got from watching Mrs. Takata teach was this incredible confidence, you know. Here's somebody from a different culture. She could express herself really, really well, but I wouldn't say she was not a flowery speaker. Her strength was in actually how few words she used.
That's true.
A lot of it was almost hand gestures, wasn't it? You
mm-hmm.
see the,
yep.
the movement of a hand like a judo chop, and all of a sudden conversation would end. You know, and I saw how her presence is what was doing the teaching.
Mm-hmm.
Because often her stories left us somewhat...
Bewildered.
Bewildered, yeah. Yeah, that's a good word. And yet not so bewildered that we didn't keep thinking about them and trying
mm-hmm.
to place them in
mm-hmm.
the context of culture
mm-hmm.
and age and
mm-hmm.
experience
mm-hmm.
because she lived through times I can't imagine.
Right.
And so I can't speak from that place.
Mm-hmm.
And being in a class with her was an experience of total attention. somebody who combined a very compassionate side also with a very direct side. I won't even say strict, but direct, you know.
Yeah.
If she thought it, she was going to say it. and we're not that used to that kind of behavior, although we often expect it from teachers of, you know, Eastern processes and
right.
techniques, you know, and in that way she fit the stereotype.
Totally.
So that's what I felt as a student of hers, And the biggest class that I organized for her was 54 people, and that was on the event of my being initiated as a Reiki master. So to see her work with a group that size and keep up with it and do all those initiations, and she did answer questions, and she had stories for every hand position, you know, and it really was an oral tradition. We were not allowed to take notes or record anything. So the idea was you remember, and if you forget, then you talk to people. You get outside of your own head and you go and discuss it with people who were there or with her or with me as her student there, and that feeds the community instead of emails flying around and people saying it was this way or that way. And so, you know, it was very important to really be present during those classes.
Right.
Those things were happening that you really wanted to hold on to.
Now, I will have to say about her stories was that way years and years afterwards, and then I would catch myself thinking about those stories again, or a story in particular, and what I realized is that she was actually, in my viewpoint, speaking about energy and how to use energy and what the most important, what the value of energy was, and how to be careful with your own, not careful in the sense of protection, but how to care for Reiki and your use of Reiki in the world. I found that fascinating, because mostly she just, it seemed like her stories were about money, but they weren't about money at all in some
way. Right, yeah. Yeah,
I always
really
found
think
that
that's
bizarre.
True. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I really think that's true. And I, even at the time, I was aware that what she was training us to do was to be receptacles that could successfully hold the amount of energy that we were about to receive. I really felt like there was this whole physical adjustment after I became initiated, getting used to, I don't know if it was a change in perspective or a change in just the energy I was carrying in my body or release of something, who knows, but it definitely was a shift for me in how I view things. And because of that, then I was reflecting something else myself. So I felt like I was kind of being polished by her, and my little dents pounded out and kind of tinkered with in a way so that I'd be able to receive what she, at that point in her life, really wanted to give.
Yes.
You know, her generosity around that was immense to me. And I often wondered sort of why me. But she did take me aside one day and she said, you know, you should give treatments now and work with lots of people, but you're a teacher, and that will be your main work. And that always stuck with me. I love giving treatments, but rather than set up a practice and be tied to that, I've chosen to teach and travel and work with people in groups and take it to there.
So how was it for you when you began to, when after she initiated you during this time, and then she left, which was the last time that you saw her, is that true?
That's true.
And then what happened after that? Like, how was that to try to teach after her?
it was remarkable. It was remarkable. I found myself, you know, talk about an ego conqueror. if I had any intention of comparing myself to her, I never could have started. You know, that didn't really enter my head. What I was very open to was remembering and receiving the energy that she carried when she taught, because she was always very clear that this isn't about me. This is about Reiki. So to be able to see 45 years of Reiki accumulated in one person looking me in the eye, you know, it was quite powerful. And I just started sitting with that before I began to teach. And then the first few sentences, I can feel my stomach and this whole somebody on my shoulder saying, "What are you doing here? You don't belong here." You know. And after about 3 minutes, it starts to flow and move, and then I'm into the words in the from another place, and that's when the teaching begins.
Right.
And that's a familiar thing to me from watching her, in a way.
Yes.
You know, when a class started, a class started. She didn't kind of walk backwards into a teaching space.
No.
Chit-chat, you know.
Right. Well, you know, it's wonderful that you bring this up, this moment up, because I feel that now, you know, it sounds so familiar, and I can remember that sensation of going, well, when's it going to kick in? It better hurry up now. And knowing that, you know, she had all these little phrases that she used to say in her classes, like, let Reiki teach you. And
watch my hand.
Watch my hand. Don't take notes. Watch my hand. And this let Reiki teach you, there was another part of that, which was, as masters, we were asked to let Reiki teach through us. And I really felt that experience, especially at the beginning, because there was such a huge difference, I believe, in my experience of being Phyllis, sort of this person that was living my daily life. And then I'd walk into a Reiki class and sit down and, as you said, you know, speak a few sentences or so on, and then it would catch. And then somehow, as Paul Mitchell would say, the pilot light ignited, and then I was on. And it wasn't me being on, it was me being able to open myself to Reiki and letting Reiki teach through me.
Yeah, and I've heard a lot of really good teachers speak, and from different disciplines, whether it's Buddhism or, you know, inspirational people of all stripes. And there, I've come to the conclusion that there's kind of a zone that I'll call, for lack of a better word, truth. You know, where it is possible to speak from a sense of wisdom or place that transcends you as an individual. And I hear it in the Dalai Lama, and I hear it in all kinds of people, friends of mine on occasion. And I hear it in you when I go to see you at gatherings and watch you kick in. It's the same thing. And that's what teaching makes you get in touch with, as opposed to treating, where I get into the energy and the space, but I don't have to respond to much.
Right.
You know.
Right. Right. Well, it's certainly a different experience, and touches one in a very different way.
Yeah.
So, which just as a kind of sort of begs to be said at this point, there's a question always about whether or not masters should teach, or if you can be a master without teaching. And I would say that if you become a master without the intention to teach, then there's no reason to become a master.
That's what I always tell people that inquire to me about it, because in that teaching process, there's this whole cauldron created where, you know, you're, well, I don't know, I'm trying to think of the proper analogy for it, but you basically learn from your students and the things that they bring to your classes.
So
to become a master not teaching and training other people to teach feels like you miss the hard part.
Right. Well, yes, because I feel that's, you know, each level has its own tool, as it were, to hone us and to, you know, purify us, if we could use that word, or at least rub off some of the rough places of our personalities. And for sure, teaching rubs the hardest, as far as I'm concerned.
And it also brings you face to face with the nature of compassion. And
yes.
One of the things that you said in the intro was that Takata never taught from a place of fear. But that didn't mean that she didn't acknowledge consequence.
Right.
But she was neutral about it. I mean,
exactly.
Okay, if you don't, you know, she wasn't a missionary. She wasn't shoving Reiki down anybody's throat, because if they didn't want it, she didn't want to waste her time. It was that simple. And she told us that, you know, you can't harm people with this, and if people really don't want it, their energy won't reach them. That's
mm-hmm.
their right. So she brought respect into it right away.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
And she said, if you're trying to misuse Reiki, it just won't work.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So that took the shame and the guilt and somebody's watching you and kind of thing out of it. And it was just simple, you know. If you don't respect it, nothing will happen.
Right.
And so I appreciated that a lot about her teaching.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So as you moved into what I would call maturity with your teaching, did you do what a lot of people did in the 1980s, which was to add things that she never had in her classes I think we were really into having powerful classes back then. So, you know, if anything added to the, the phenomenology of the class, like somebody having a breakdown or somebody having a spontaneous rebirth or somebody having a great life insight or something, that was a powerful class. So that seemed to be somehow, I don't know how we got into this, our value. And did you escape that and just teach from her?
Well, I tried to be as true to what I tried to teach as much what she taught as
uh-huh.
I could without trying to be her.
Right.
So in the beginning, I used her stories because she was my teacher, and
right.
I felt like I had permission to use her life as an illustration, because I was
mm-hmm.
a baby Reiki master. Didn't have enough of my own, although if you think about it, I probably had other experiences that could be used for teaching purposes. But anyway, as I taught more and as I had more experiences with classes and treating people and relationships around Reiki, that I began to have my own tales to tell.
Mm-hmm.
And slowly my language for it got more contemporary, because I'm here, and less about her early life in Hawaii.
Mm-hmm.
And it started to feel like it was mine to hold for
mm-hmm.
now. That it, instead of borrowing it or having it put upon me, I accepted it, and it was mine. And in that, I got the experiences and anecdotes
mm-hmm.
that I needed to teach my way.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of form, I've been really quite a stickler about maintaining as much of that as I possibly
mm-hmm.
can remember and hold on to.
Mm-hmm.
And so I still don't like notes or recorders.
Right.
I still like people to listen. I still like an oral tradition. I've had to use new media for some things, but, you know, I'm a musician as well, and it's funny. I have no compunction about using new media for music, because it's always been a media,
uh-huh.
as new as it could be from the time they started recording it. So I don't have a problem promoting myself as a musician online. It's a lot harder for me to think about an online presence with Reiki, because part of that has been that it, what Takata taught was, you know, they'll find you, find you.
Mm-hmm.
And here I am putting out a website and all this stuff, you know, so it's something I struggle with still.
Right, I agree. That's hard to figure
yeah.
it out.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, you know, the interesting thing that I just twigged on is that, you know, in music, if you take the same song that's delivered or performed isn't really a great word, but I would say delivered by different artists, they will each make that song theirs, and it comes out of them in their own way, but it's still the same song. And I find that to be true about Reiki classes, that, you know, your class now and my class, since I've dropped all my stuff and have gone back to basically what she taught, as I can nearly as I can remember, with the help of some friends, there's a similarity of, you know, the outline, so to speak, of the class, but our classes are quite different because you're a different person than I am.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
I find that so fascinating that, you know, I send, you know, students who want to be, who are aspiring masters to different people's classes because I want them to see not only the similarities, but the differences.
Yeah.
Like how they can make, how they can be their own master.
Well, that's the fun of doing, spending time with the international community.
Yes.
It's
yes.
different in different places. And when you say class, right away, what is that? Is that a bunch of people sitting under a tree? Or is it a desk and a pad of paper and a dictaphone?
Right.
Or, you know,
right.
is it a, what is the, just the word class in terms of different cultures means this whole set of behaviors that we may not even appreciate.
Right.
So, I mean, I'm curious about you teaching in the Russian satellite countries and there, because that's a very different culture than I've worked in, you know. And, and the way the culture transfers to there is going to be different than it is in the Netherlands or in in the UK.
Right, right. So, have you taught in the Netherlands and the UK and other countries?
Well, yeah, and I've actually for a while I was doing going to conferences sometimes. I did one for in Norway with a group there that were outside of the Sui Shiki Ryoho, but the rumors were rampant. And I just thought, well, okay, we got Reiki in common at some level. I'd like to meet these people. And they came to a talk of mine in London I gave, rather skeptical at first. And then a week later, I got an invitation to come to their conference in Norway and speak there. And it was really neat. That was a very different form. But it made sense to them. What can I say? You know, and we had some really good talks, and I spent a full day with them working on different things and talking about my own experiences. I felt really well treated and respected, and like there was communication and acceptance around that. So as I get older, I more and more see the Reiki as the pulse of the world. And it really, I have a form that I like teaching because that's the one I learned. And somebody else is coming from another place so that I don't really have to get involved in that. It's their choice, you know. But I feel the Reiki also in the time I spend in my garden and in the time that music is coming through me and in the time that I spend doing family stuff and working in my own community here. I live in a small community. And all that energy just moving around, energy in motion. That's what I always say. If you want a non-religious and non-scientific and non-ideologue kind of description of Reiki, it's energy in motion. It's the source energy, and that comes through everything we express ourselves through. So I love where my path has taken me now because I'm teaching a bit less now. People have to find me. And I do teach on when there's a request to teach, but I'm not actively seeking students, and I'm also very involved in the music and in just living where I live. And I think that's one of the things Takata would appreciate, actually. That there are people staying in one place. So,
something to be said about that, for sure.
Somebody asked Gary Snyder years ago in the 60s, what can we do to help the environment? And he thought for a minute, and he said, stay home. I think that at some level becomes more and more true as we see the effects of all our movements and travels. But, you know, it doesn't mean the loss of the Reiki community, because obviously we're all working with an energy that's common wherever you are. So
uh-huh.
That's a nice thing.
Right. Well, I think that one of the big leaps, if you to stay on this for a minute, one of the big leaps in our Reiki community is to go from the physical to the non-physical. And I think, you know, in our communities, and one of the things that's my challenge these days is to really be able to give as much credence to the non-physical world as to the physical world. And Reiki should have taught me this. Like, when I first started to teach and practice Reiki, it was just like almost a fantasy for me. Like, things were so, like, miraculous, because I couldn't imagine anything like this ever working, because it wasn't real, because it wasn't physical. And in the last 30 years, this energy has become more and more physical, until now I can feel it in the air, or I can feel it within me, or I can feel it grow in me. When, you know, in the last few months, so many people are sending me Reiki, I can feel a day when maybe there's 100 people sending me Reiki instead of 500 or something like that. I mean, it's very interesting. And the more physical, and I would say, use the word physical in a very light way, the more physical Reiki becomes to me, the more I realize that I need to match that with trust, that I need to be able to trust my non-physicalness as much as I trust my physicalness. Because actually, my physicalness is an illusion.
Yes. And it's so hard.
Which is a head scratcher.
Right. Oh, I understand. I understand.
Yeah.
And, you know, from the time we got second degree, we've been accepting the notion of sending energy.
Yeah, exactly.
And for me, that's expanded to being energy.
Uh-huh.
And this is what I saw in Mrs. Takata on a physical level when we were together, that all of a sudden this little tiny woman who was traveling a lot and looked really frail, all of a sudden when she began a class, wow, it's just like she'd inflate and stand before you and look completely solid. Well, you know, I treated her after those classes, and I remember how tired she could be after she stepped down from that energy place where she taught from.
Uh-huh.
And so I think that the hidden gift in Reiki is that we are aware of energetic communication, and when times get tough, we need to rely on that more,
uh-huh.
because the physical just won't work all the time.
Right.
You know?
I mean, I find it quite fascinating, just, you know, lately in the news about this volcano in Iceland that has disturbed so many people's travel experience.
Yeah. All it takes
is one volcano.
One volcano, and there's no, everybody stays home.
See, nature is telling us the same thing. Stay home.
Well, I'm glad nature did it this week, because I'm supposed to fly to London next week. I haven't learned it all yet, that's for sure.
Well, it was fascinating. I mean, I had this smirk on my face a bit when I was told this. Of course, because I get things kind of second and third hand, because I hardly ever listen to news. So it was just it's an amazing experience to imagine that we all plan our lives and we think we have so much in control, and then all of a sudden this volcano blows up and...
Yeah.
You know, everything goes to pieces.
So much for stability.
Really.
You know, the myth of stability.
But you know, one of the things that has been feedback through a lot of friends of mine who are in the UK and Europe, in other parts of Europe and so on, is that people are just loving it. Like they just go, oh, okay, well, I can't go, and there's nobody to blame. So I'll just, I mean, this one little family is having an extra 12 days of vacation.
Right.
Because they can't get home. And they just have to give it up, and their employers have to just give it up. And
yeah.
It's been very beautiful, I
yeah.
think.
Yeah.
Really amazing. Really great.
Yeah. Yeah, it's not a bad thing. And think of how quiet, you know, how noisy the skies are in Europe.
Yeah.
I mean, living in Leiden in the Netherlands, we're only 20 minutes from the airport. And so there were always jets coming overhead.
Can you imagine a week or, well, say 4 days without any of that noise?
Yeah, that's amazing.
Yeah, there was some man who was interviewed on television evidently, who lives near the London Heathrow Airport, and he said, well, I'm kind of sorry for all the people who can't fly, but it's been really lovely. Really lovely. So, you know, one of the things that is interesting for me is that there is this, kind of mythology maybe, or hopefully, maybe some defense mechanism that grew up in us when we were able to say, well, Reiki's calling us to go somewhere, you know, and so we get on a plane and, you know, fly to Timbuktu or something. And I just wonder where that comes from and what your opinion is of that, and also what Reiki is calling us to do now. Is it calling us to stay home?
Well, I think it depends who we are.
Uh-huh.
I mean, it's been, 30 years for us now.
A little, mm-hmm.
Yeah. And I spent since 1998 traveling well over half the year. And yet I've always been a person that felt like developing networks in your local community was really important in terms of happiness and survival in some cases, especially we live on an island. And all it takes is the ferry to be down, and all of a sudden there's no groceries here, and people rely on each other. So we've tried to plan for that sort of thing if it should ever happen on a wider scale.
Right.
And so I feel like right now, being where I am, I feel quite of service here, and also that it nurtures me on other levels. So I continue to travel, but I tend to bunch it together once or twice a year and go for a bit. And yet I'm still fascinated by the world and the people where they are, but for me it feels like time to maybe write more and have a more solitary life, more time to think and to meditate on things and to watch energy at work around me.
Mm-hmm.
And so I feel like that still benefits the community at large, given that most of us exists in a non-physical dimension.
Right.
So I don't feel like I'm slacking off on the non-physical level.
Ah, Reiki, the balance of form and essence.
Right. Yeah.
Yes. Well, to go back to kind of a physical part of this form of teaching, when you started to teach in the Netherlands or outside of your home country of Canada at this point, did you notice anything that pulled at you? Like, as the Reiki came through you, did you notice that you were telling maybe different stories, or there was a different way that you structured the class, or was it all about the same for you?
It was different in some ways. One of the things was that I didn't know the forms of politeness necessarily.
Uh-huh.
Even you know, just small things, how people acknowledge each other, how they are about eye contact.
Mm-hmm.
Where is touching, like shaking hands or hugs or something, where's the limit of that in
right.
the cultures? And I don't speak Dutch, and the Dutch are so wonderful about speaking every other language
really?
On earth. North Americans come from a frontier consciousness.
Uh-huh.
Some part of them is always in their grandfather's ranch or farm or the history or, you know, in BC, the whole movement of us that moved into the mountains and were all involved in self-sufficiency, all of that stuff. That's not really the primary concern in a lot of Europe.
Right.
They're very modern people. They're contemporary. They're intelligent. They think about things. The Dutch in particular seem to be direct and honest when they have a feeling about or an opinion about something.
Mm-hmm.
They'll say it, you know. Whereas that's different in other countries where the meaning is lying under the words somewhere and
right.
you need to learn what those signals are. So
right.
it was a big learning curve for me to teach. In terms of teaching differently, I found that, you know, my animal stories were very interesting to people because it was totally out of their experience. And I lived in the bush for years, so I met a lot of animals, you know, and yet it might not be particularly applicable to their culture and situation. So I do think you choose different stories at
uh-huh.
different times for different groups, depending
mm-hmm.
on what you feel will reach them. That's
mm-hmm.
the beauty of an oral tradition.
Mm-hmm.
If we had a manual I was teaching from or a course curriculum, everybody would get the same stuff, and that would be a pity because they can only understand what fits their consciousness.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And yet the interesting thing is that the basic practice is delivered, and it's the same stuff, but delivered in different ways in order to fit a certain cultural receptivity.
Yeah.
So this brings me to an interesting place where I think about myself as a teacher, and I'm not using this as a master slash teacher, but teacher in the sense of this is one of my jobs as a master is to teach.
Yeah.
And one of the things that was so interesting for me to realize is that it's communication is not just about the way that I speak and how clearly I speak, but the willingness to allow for the listener.
Yes.
Because the listener is really 50% of communication.
Yeah.
And if we keep rambling on in jargon, American jargon, as we're teaching a class in some other language, then there's no way that I'm going to be able to communicate.
And I find that the percentage of attention that goes to what I'm saying as opposed to what I'm listening to changes in a different culture, and
mm-hmm.
I listen more.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I have to listen more.
Right.
I have to pay more attention just to understand what's
mm-hmm.
happening.
Mm-hmm. So, and that's not such a bad thing, really.
It's a great thing. It's a great thing. I get tired of hearing myself talk sometimes, you know, and even when I'm on the right track, I realize that I'm verbally very comfortable, and sometimes for me, it's more important to feel and listen to the
mm-hmm.
students and what's in the room.
Mm-hmm.
Teaching in different cultures actually can make that easier because you have to
mm-hmm.
have any communication at all.
That's great. Well, you know, I assume that you have felt this in all of your classes across wherever you've taught, and that is that there's something inside of me that responds to the class in a different way for each of the classes, and also responds to different students in a different way. It's kind of like there's some kind of weird sensor that goes on that at one point I can be quite direct, like my grandmother, and another time somebody might ask me the same question and I would be much more soft in my response.
Yes, yes.
And it doesn't come from my head. It comes from something inside of me.
Yeah.
I don't know what that is, except just to say that it's, you know, it's the way Reiki works through me. But
yeah,
the way also that it opens me to respond so in the moment and so individually that it's the magic of oral tradition for me.
Yes.
Part of it.
Yes. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree. It's not just menopause.
Oh, thanks.
Because it happens to me, too.
Oh, yeah. Are you delivering yourself from a sexist remark?
Yes.
Okay, well, so there was something else that you wanted to speak to when we were going through the little agenda of our conversation today, and it was about how Reiki has touched you and how teaching has touched you.
Yeah, and how I mean, I've always seen Reiki as a road, you know. In Native medicine, they talked about traveling the red road.
Right.
And in Reiki, we have a road too. And the temptation to compare yourself to someone else in terms of your Reiki is not necessary when you see it, that just somebody got on this road and started walking, and later on you got on the road and started
right.
walking. And when you've been doing it as long as they have, you'll see what they're seeing, and that there's a direction and a flow to this life.
Uh-huh.
That we've chosen. And the more that I do it, the more I get the story that Mrs. Takata told about first she felt Reiki in her hands when she started treating people, and then it moved up her arms, and then she felt it coming from her chest. And at the time I met her, she described it more as a cocoon of energy that surrounded her.
Uh-huh.
And that she felt protected and safe and at home wherever she was. And to some extent, I'm becoming cognizant of that, that my own personal path with the Reiki has brought me to a very lovely place these days.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not perfect, and life isn't everything that it could be, but what it is really beautiful and really precious. And the Reiki makes me more and more aware of all sort of the noise of creation all around me.
Mm-hmm.
I guess that's what it feels like, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm grateful for that. It allows me to continue to have a huge relationship with my practice even when I'm not around people.
That is a really interesting comment.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. But so true.
So I'm excited by the future around all of this as well. And acknowledging that form changes and has changed just by virtue of time and culture since Dr. Sui's time. As long as we maintain our core integrity around Reiki, our respect for it and respect for where we received it from, that it will continue to evolve to fit the circumstances that we find ourselves in.
Mm-hmm. So just to be more clear about what you just said, I see you're not giving people permission to just teach however they want.
No. Not entirely, because I have this issue about integrity.
Mm-hmm.
Because what really did the teaching was Takata's presence, and that's framed by her integrity at the level that was required. And so if you're working with the precepts and the ideas behind Reiki, then you need to be really honest with yourself about how you walk that.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So my issues are less about form than integrity.
Yeah, that's true. And the interesting thing for me is that the form has a kind of integrity that, like, on all the classes that I sat in with her, the form of the class that she taught was not changed very much.
No.
From one to another. I mean, you know, in the sense of the number of hours and what she did and what she taught and so on, that was really very, well, I don't want to say standard, but very similar each time. And that, for me, gave me a certain security as to teach myself, but also gave me security as a student. And I noticed that a lot of students came and reviewed, especially in BC, because that was sort of, I don't know, an understood thing, you know, to come back to the teacher and learn again. And I think that that's something that in many cultures is actually frowned upon. It's like, well, if you didn't learn it the first time, then why would you be so stupid as to go back again? And yet in a lot of different cultures, it's like, you know, to go back and be in the class shows that you are open to being a student and to receiving something different, even though the class is basically the same.
Well, and I think what a lot of students don't take advantage of is the actual depth of commitment that most Reiki teachers have for them.
Right.
So that they feel like, oh, well, the class is over. I can't ask them anything. I can't write to them. I can't I can't pursue this idea further. I can't go see anyone else because I learned from them. That kind of thing. And I really like to leave the door open. Part of the oral tradition is access.
Right.
If you don't have access and you can't take notes and you can't film it or record
right.
it, then how do we keep a form at all?
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, that's a very good point. Well, Rick, we're almost at the end of our time together, amazingly.
It does fly.
So I just wonder if there's any last words of wisdom that you would like to impart to our listeners?
Wow, this is my last words of wisdom.
Well, for this time. I'm sure you'll be on the show more times than...
Well, I think at the heart of this practice is a sense of compassion. It's not about healing people, and it's not about teaching people, and it's not about being something that you aren't. It's just about learning to feel more completely what's going on around you, and open yourself to that. And in that space, things change. So for myself, I keep trying to get to a place of allowing myself to feel what is going on in the world around me.
Thank you.
Yeah.
That's beautiful.
Thank you, Phyllis.
Always good to have you on the show.
It's great to talk to you.
Yes, wonderful. Yeah. Well, listeners, unfortunately, this is the end of our broadcast today, and we bid Rick adieu, and we'll be back next week. So this is Phyllis Furumoto with Reiki, Balancing Form and Essence.